Direct. From Guano Productions headquarters in the Los Angeles Underground, it's time for your new favorite podcast, The Superiority Complex. It's like honey in your ear holes.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. We're doing something special this time. We don't have the full crew with me. I just have my lovely wife here. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
I don't know why that made me laugh. Hi.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Hermano. We're actually going to be doing something a lot different for us on this podcast.
Yeah, we read a book.
We read a book that wasn't...
Harry Potter.
It wasn't Harry Potter or a comic book.
Or Sherlock Holmes.
We actually, this book was actually recommended to us by one of our favorite listeners, Miss Stephanie. You know her as the Lily Pot. The Lily Pot Standish. She does beautiful work over there.
Agreed.
Right?
Agreed.
Follow her. You know what? I should have this ready. I'm a terrible host. You know, because she has an underscore in her name, and those always throw me. Because I'm dumb. My beautiful wife, with nimble fingers, looking up the name. She recommended this book to us. It's called The Woman in Black. It was written by Susan Hill. It was published in 1983. And there is a movie version starring...
Harry Potter,
that's right. There's also a TV movie version that I found on YouTube. Stephanie said to skip the Harry Potter version. It's not good. Mm-hmm. But she said to definitely check out the TV movie. And I found it. I've been waiting for us to finish the book so that we could watch it together.
So it looks like it's... The Lily Pot underscore.
It's the Lily Pot underscore. And you can follow her on Twitter and on Instagram. And she's a budding florist.
Nope.
I just got a dirty look from my kid who is seated behind my wife. And I'm getting now they've high-fived against me. Two against one. See? Hey, children are to be seen and not heard. Please remember that. Okay? Thank you. You can't lose when you're winning all the time also. Hashtag winning. So. You know what? It's weird. It's weird not having a microphone in front of me. It's weird not having headphones on.
Yeah.
I think that's a
silly. It feels weird.
It does feel weird. Do you want to just throw headphones on just to make ourselves feel better?
Just to dampen the noise of our own voices.
Just to set the scene here, we're not using all of our podcast equipment that we usually use. I do have stuff set up for home use, but we're using just our little Roland R05 digital recorder. It's fantastic. It's got 6 onboard microphones, Nicole. How does that make you feel?
Fine.
Yeah. Picks up a lot of ambient noise, though. That's the only problem. We had to turn the fan off. We're down here in the bunker, surrounded by games.
We left the AC on
because it's miserably hot outside. Another hot Los Angeles underground summer. But we're excited to talk about this book. Now, before we get into the book, and again, thank you to Stephanie for the recommendation, I wanted to give everybody, you already mentioned Harry Potter, I wanted to just give a little background about the stuff that we normally like to read. What do you like to read, Nicole? What are your types of books? And remember, no judgments here, because I read a heck of a lot of comic books.
You're a judgy Judgerson, so...
No, I am not.
I mean, I'm all over the place. I like books that, same as movies, I like to just be transported and kind of taken out of my world for a little bit. So, that's what I... Like, one of my favorite books is The Secret Life of Bees.
Okay.
I love that book.
I've never read it. Yeah, I tend to read. I'm the opposite. Whereas, you know, movies, I want them to be as fantastical as possible. I want to read. You know, I want to see science fiction stuff like that. I have very little interest in reading about that stuff. I tend to read a lot of books on history, a lot of fact-based stuff. I do read some historical fiction. A lot of Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes is like the only thing I'll read. It's kind of sort of maybe like the 1940s detective novels, you know, the Dashiell Hammett and, you know, the Philip Marlowe detective novels and all that good stuff. I do like that, but I don't read a lot of sci-fi.
I don't read really anything historically based.
I don't read a lot of horror. And this is definitely a horror story.
I guess the closest I would come to have read horror before, and it's maybe loosely associated, is The Road.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's like, I do like post-apocalyptic stuff. I will read a lot of stuff like that. Yeah. And The Road is just depressing as all get out.
Yeah.
But it's good. It's a good book.
There were some scenes in that like, I literally jumped while reading.
I remember you told me you threw the book across the room at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. I was excited to read this book because, I mean, Sherlock Holmes is my bread and butter. So, as soon as I started reading it, you know, it grabs you with that Victorian-style narrative.
Yeah.
It very, very put me in the mind of
it. But I feel like that's where the similarities
sort of end.
Yeah.
It's just it's written in that style, definitely. But yeah, this is a polar opposite of a Sherlock Holmes style. The closest one I would say would be Hound of the Baskervilles. Because they're so good at describing the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Hound of the Baskervilles, if no one's read it, and it's a slight spoiler alert, it's a sort of supernatural tale.
The dog did it.
Sherlock Holmes really didn't...
I don't know that for sure.
Sherlock Holmes really didn't deal in the supernatural. There was an I think he did one... I almost said episode. He did one short story that had to do with a novel. A vampire. And it was because Dracula was kind of all the rage at the time the story was written. But it turned out not to be a vampire. But if you're only going to read one Sherlock Holmes story, I always recommend Hound of the Baskervilles. Because Sherlock Holmes isn't in it a lot, it's very atmospheric. And I think it's a lot of what Susan Hill accomplishes here is kind of the same thing, where you're describing this sort of eerie landscape in this kind of, it takes you out of... And for me, a story like this, part of the appeal of reading those stories... And like watching shows like the, you know, stuff on like Mystery on PBS, where it's all these shows from the BBC, is that we have no frame of reference for the landscape or the cities or the towns or anything. True. So everything looks kind of exotic to us, you know.
Yeah.
So it kind of adds a layer to that. So I'll tell you one thing that grabbed me about this book was it's hard to pin down what era it is. We took the kid to see Kiki's Delivery Service the other day, and we talked about how it's this weird mix where there's cars and there's television, but the cars all look like they're from the 1930s, and they're using the phones with a handset, but they also have radio and TV, like it was as strong, and so some of the people look fairly fashionable. They're not wearing old fashioned clothes, but it's really weird. It's this weird mix of technology from across different eras.
Yeah.
And I felt this with the story. It's hard to pin down when it is. Because there's cars, obviously, and trains.
Yeah, I guess I thought it was... I mean, I'm really bad at pinning down that time frame. But I kind of got the feeling that, like, it was London when they had all that really bad smog from, like, the coal refineries.
Yeah, so there would have been like Victorian London.
Yeah, yeah, like people like literally dying in the streets because you can't see 2 inches in front of your face. That's kind of the way he makes London feel so drab.
Mm-hmm.
That was what it made me think of.
So yeah, the idea that there's cars kind of, for me, puts it a little bit later. But I'm sure they still have the same problems. I mean, you know. So by the end of the book, I was convinced it was the early, maybe, you know, around World War I. Maybe there's no mention of the war, but around that, you know, you have cars and telephones, so
yeah,
and the cars are pretty prevalent because Mr. I forgot what's his name is driving him around at the end of the, and the car brings his fiance to see him, so
true.
We know there's vehicles, but that was the one thing that struck me right away is that she kind of left it open ended as to when the story took place, and that adds for me. Added a little bit more of a little bit of mystery to this whole story, which I liked to the proceedings. So let's get into at the end of the book. There was a little reading guide, and we're just going to kind of take that as a little. We're going to use that as our guide for this discussion. And if you haven't read the book, pause it now. We'll wait. We'll be here when you get back, and let's discuss some of these questions. We're not going to get to them all, but Let's go to this question. Looking out over the marshes, Arthur feels that he had fallen under a certain had fallen under some sort of spell of the kind that certain places exude, and it drew me, my imaginings, my longings, my curiosity, my whole spirit toward itself. Why is he so drawn to the marshes? Has he fallen under a spell? Well, let's set the story. We talked about all this.
Yeah.
So the protagonist of the story, it opens on Christmas Eve, he's with his family, and he decides he's going to set down this story that happened to him when he was a younger man. So it's sort of a story within a story. And that story opens with this young man. He's a junior partner in a law office.
I would assume, yeah.
And he's sent to this small town of, I forgot the name of it. It's a fictional town. You don't know where it is. It's on the English coast somewhere. I should have this. I'm a terrible host because I forgot the name of the town. He's sent to investigate some papers of a Mrs. Drablow who has died. And she lives on this really spooky house. Eel Marsh,
yeah.
Eel, as in the animal, and marsh, as in mallow. So he is gonna as soon as he gets to the town, he starts telling people what his business there is for. He's told, don't go into the house, you know, don't, it's haunted. He's starting to hear all these things,
or people just don't even want to have further discussion with him. And
that's right, he attends Mrs. Drablow's funeral.
Yes.
There's no one there save for the representative of the law office there in the town, and the minister.
Yes.
While he's at the graveside, he sees an image of a woman dressed all in black, and also sees a line of children staring at him from the other side, along the fence of the graveyard, kind of just staring at him. So that's the scene. And so now his whole job is he's determined he's going to go to this house, he's going to go to Eel Marsh, he's going to spend the night there, or he's going to spend as much time there as it takes to
go through the paperwork,
and then report back to London with his findings. So this is early on in the book. He's out bicycling on the marshes, and he's out just cycling, kind of getting the lay of the land. And we come across this paragraph. I intended to cycle to the next village where I hoped to find another country inn and enjoy some bread and cheese and beer for lunch. But as I reached the last of the houses, I could not resist the urge that was so extraordinarily strong within me to stop and look, not westward, where I might see farms and fields and the distant roofs of a village, but east. And there they lay, those glittering, beckoning silver marshes with the sky pale at the horizon where it reached down to the water of the estuary. A thin breeze blew off them with salt on its breath. Even from as far away as this, I could hear the mysterious silence, and once again the haunting, strange beauty of it all aroused a response deep within me. I could not run away from that place. I would have to go back to it. Not now, but soon. I had fallen under some sort of spell of the kind that certain places exude, and it drew me to my imaginings, my longings, my curiosity, my whole spirit toward itself. For a long time I looked and looked and recognized what was happening to me. My emotions had now become so volatile and so extreme, my nervous responses so near the surface, so rapid and keen, that I was living in another dimension. My heart seemed to beat faster, my step to be quicker, everything I saw was brighter, its outlines more sharply, precisely defined. One thing I failed to mention there is that the day before he had visited the house, and he again sees the woman in black at the graveyard. There's a small graveyard, family graveyard at the house, and he sees the woman in black and is terrified, runs away, and decides that he's not going to stay at the house, but will kind of go back and forth. And then later on in the book, he says, you know what, I need to just man up. And in the Victorian sense, I need to have my wits about me and see this through to the end. So going back to that question, what do you think that was, Nicole? Do you think that was the sort of the spell? Was he under a spell from The Woman in Black, or is that something that, was he just being fanciful?
Yeah, I feel like he, while he thought himself to be, I don't know if pragmatic is the right word, like, I don't think he thought he would be taken with, like, spirits and that sort of thing, but I think unwittingly he found himself sensitive to that and maybe drawn to it.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing. Like, this time in England, like, spiritualism is kind of a thing. Even Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes author, was kind of taken in by pictures of fairies. I think there were people that definitely wanted to believe, but nothing in his character that you read from the opening part of the story would kind of give you the idea that he was under that, he would kind of be, you know, prone to that kind of thinking. One thing you have to do when with this story is you just have to assume that there is the supernatural element is there.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, I actually didn't even assume that. Like, I was going with it on whatever road it took me on, and I figured there could be, she could ride away where there is concrete, quote-unquote, earthly reasons for what he was seeing and that.
You were waiting for the Scooby-Doo moment, like...
I was waiting for the possibility of it.
Yeah, I'm saying this as, having read it.
Yeah, having read
having
it,
read
yeah.
it now, it's like, okay, this
but
is...
But as I was reading it, I wasn't trying to make any assumptions about who she was and all that kind of stuff. So I think it could have gone either way at that point.
So why do you think he's drawn to the Martians? Do you think it's a spell or do you think it's just the idea that he has to kind of find out what's going on?
Like I said, I think he just, he has an unwitting sensitivity to that spiritual stuff that he didn't think he had.
So you think he's kind of got like a latent...
Yeah, I think it like he's just
sympathetic vibrations, as we would say on the Haunted Mansion. Okay, that's interesting because I'm not sure why. I felt like he had seen the place. It was mysterious enough that he wanted to go back and wanted to find out what was going on. And in the back of his mind, probably knew, maybe because of what you said, maybe he knew that something was amiss and needed to, under the pretext of going there to do his paperwork, kind of find out, dig a little deeper.
And find out and make sure that he's not crazy.
Yeah.
That he's not just seeing things.
Have I seen what I've seen?
Yeah. Like, I need to have a job that's set before me. I need to complete that task. And I also need to know that I'm not, like, insane.
That's a good point. He wants to make sure... Confirm that he's seen what he's seen.
Yeah.
Arthur Kipps decides to write his ghost story in order to exorcise it so that he can finally be free of it for whatever life remained for me to enjoy. Does Arthur free himself from the trauma he suffered at Eel Marsh House? Why would the act of telling a deeply painful or traumatic story have such healing power? I feel like he was able to move on, definitely, because...
Yeah, he has a family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he did move on. So, I think... I mean, but he moved on before writing his story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just feel like... We all... Like, it's just kind of common knowledge when you have a trauma... At some point, you got to talk about it. At some point, you got to face it and try to work through it to try to, you know, release its, like, hold on you. So, as a real life, like, story, I think it would help to, at some point, finally write all this down or tell it all to somebody so it's not just a burden on you.
Even if he never published it, just getting the act of getting it out. Getting it on paper, reliving
it. It's therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
To see it all the way through to the end.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, for anybody would be therapeutic to...
Well, it's also a sort of a... It's in putting it down on paper, you're making these events that happen to you and have only... been replayed in your mind, you're setting it in sort of in concrete.
Yeah, you make it real.
There's tangible evidence that this happened. Yeah.
So if he passes and his family finds these documents, they can read about what happened to him.
Why might Hill have chosen to frame the main narrative of the woman in black with Arthur's experience of spending Christmas Eve with his family at the beginning and contemplating his own death at the end? What effect does this frame have on how the story is read? Do you want to go first, or do you want me to answer that?
No, go ahead.
Well, I think she chooses to frame it because you have to wonder. It's one of those things, you see this guy, he's got a happy life, and he's, you know, obviously surrounded by the family he loves, but something's bothering him at the beginning. He's got these, you know, he's angry about, you know, he's remembering these things, and he realizes he's got to get this story down.
Yeah.
And you realize that it sort of casts a shadow over his whole life, the rest of his life. He was able to move on, but it's still there at the back of his mind. And so I think it sort of adds a little element of drama because you want to know what happened. It compels you, the reader, like just like Arthur is compelled to uncover the secrets of Eelmarsh House. I think the reader is, you're trying to uncover the mystery too, just to see how he got from A to B.
Yeah, because you know he survives it, like because he's still there, but as he's nearing the end of his days, mm-hmm. you know, and he's looking back on how much he's been through.
Mm-hmm.
Like it, you know, told from the perspective of an older man who's come through it, moved on with his life. I think that's, for me, I feel like that's why she starts it, you know, Christmas Eve with the family and ending it with him contemplating mm-hmm. his end.
Yeah, because you you basically know how it's going to end, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee a happy ending.
Yes.
So I like that. That's a nice little mechanic there.
Yeah.
By what means does Hill build and sustain a high level of tension and suspense throughout The Woman in Black? What are some of the novel's most terrifying moments? I know what the scariest moment... I mean, for me, it's the description. The way she describes the marshes. The way she describes the house. It's this giant, drafty house that he's lighting lamps like... I guess there's electricity because there is. I don't remember because he's turning on the lights. He's turning on the light switch.
Yes.
So there's electricity in the house. He has a flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's just even during the day. I think when he sees the woman in black, and he realizes that when he sees her at the graveside, he realizes she's not alive. Is that correct? Doesn't he see that she's kind of got like a.
No, I don't. I think he's still.
But at one point, or am I misremembering? Does he describe what he sees under her veil, or he can kind of make it out that she's dressed all in black in funeral clothes? She's got a veil. I thought he described maybe seeing
her,
like.
I mean, like her skin was a bit taut, but I don't know that he knew her as dead
mm-hmm.
or an apparition or what have you.
Yeah, I think there's the one scene when the kids are all staring at him, and they're just kind of staring at him kind of dead-eyed. That's a little unsettling.
Yeah.
Because kids are creepy.
And I didn't quite get that connection until the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that didn't quite freak me out until the end, and I started thinking about it.
Yeah. Definitely, for me, it's just the description of the house being so big and drafty. He's there alone. And then there's this great thing about... that you can only get to the house through this causeway twice a day
mm-hmm.
when tide is low. So when the tide is high, the water covers the estuary, and the only way to get out there is with a pony and a cart or a trap, as mm-hmm. they say. And the pony might drown. So there's really no way. I don't think that it'll hold the weight of a car. Or it's just underwater, so you can't drive. So you're basically cut off from the rest of the civilization for at least, you know, for just a very short time, twice a day, you can get back to the town. And this house is outside of town. It's out on the marshes, away from the rest of the town. So he's almost completely cut off from any sort of help. There's no one living out there. The house is this big, kind of foreboding and drafty house.
Yeah.
The old woman, Mrs. Drablo, lived there by herself. Nobody wants to talk about her. The only person who will drive him out there is Mr. I forgot his name.
Keckwick.
Keckwick takes him out there in... Keckwick, what a great British name. He takes him out there in a cart. Doesn't say much either. Nobody wants to talk about Mrs. Drablo. Nobody wants to talk about the house. They just keep telling him, don't go out there. Don't go out there. You know, you're better off staying here. So there's already this sense of dread when you get to the house.
Yeah.
And then once when he decides to stay in the house and she describes what goes on at night, he's already, at one point he hears what he thinks is Mr. Keckwick coming to get him. He can't see, but he hears a cart and a pony. And then the cart and the pony splash into the water. And he hears a child crying to be rescued.
Yeah.
And the child then he hears the child drown. But he can't see anything. For me, the scariest moment is when he's in the... He's at one point, he... I'm bad with character names. The gentleman who lends him the dog...
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Daly? Is it Mr. Daly?
The...
I think it's the Dalys.
Yes.
Mr. Daly, who's a kind of a well-to-do guy in town, he meets him on the train coming in, kind of gives him some advice, and then he says, you know what? If you're going to stay out there at the house, you're going to need some company. I'm going to lend you my dog. So he lends Arthur a dog named Spider. And Spider quickly becomes your favorite character in the book.
Yes, I was real afraid. I was like, if Spider dies, I stop reading.
Spider is a stalwart companion, and at one point in the middle of the night is barking because they can hear a noise. And the dog is not happy. The dog starts barking at the only door in the house that cannot be accessed. It's locked. Seemingly from the inside, no matter how many Arthur tries every key, tries to break the door down, all to no avail. And and then once the, of course, because it's a ghost story, the door eventually opens.
Yeah.
And then that's when Spider cowers away. And I think that's the point when I was like, oh my God, what's happening?
Yeah, all that stuff in the nursery was the most frightening stuff in the book for me.
Yeah. Well, later on, yeah. I'm sorry. It's revealed to be a nursery. And he keeps hearing a noise. And the noise is something he associates with his childhood, but he can't.
Yeah. See, that's what was frightening for me, because there was that string to his comfort from his childhood and the surroundings and how it was, like, almost identical to his childhood nursery. But then also a string to the fear of,
mm-hmm,
why is the room open now? Why was the rocking chair rocking?
Yeah.
Like, what are the noises we're hearing?
The noises he was hearing was...
It was kind of weaved together very nicely to where you felt... you felt both things. And it was like, I didn't know which route the author was going to take. Like, is this going to be something about his childhood coming back? Was this just, you know, I didn't quite know where she was going to take it, but I liked that. I don't like to be able to telegraph everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked that I couldn't quite tell where she was going to go.
Yeah, he opens the door. He keeps hearing this noise and he can't figure out what it is. He hears it over the course of a couple of nights. And I figured it out pretty late that it was a rocking chair.
I didn't figure it out. It wasn't until she said it was a rocking
chair. Yeah, I mean, it was this noise he associated with his childhood in a way. So he said, while he was scared, he was struck by the idea. He's like, I know this sound.
Yeah.
I know that noise. And it was the sound of a chair being rocked back and forth on a wooden floor. And so, obviously, being the nursery, you assume someone's rocking a baby, a ghost baby. And his description of the room is that it's very neat. There's toys laid out, you know, very neatly on the shelves. Everything is just as if there's still a child living in the house.
Yeah.
Arthur reflects that before the events at Ealhmarsh House, he was in a state of innocence, and that even though he is happy now, innocence once lost is lost forever. In what ways was Arthur innocent before he encountered the woman in black? Why does the experience rob him of his innocence?
Well, I think, again, you know, he's a lawyer and lives in London and, you know, more cosmopolitan for, you know, the time or what have you. But I feel like he knew, thought he knew what he knew. And so I think that was his innocence of not realizing that there was this spiritual realm that was still, or, you know, had any power to affect the real world.
And that's exactly right. And it's, I don't think I would have used the word innocence. Ignorance would have been the word I would have used. Not willful ignorance. He just didn't know that this sort of thing is gone. And now he has to live with the idea that there is a spiritual realm that can harm.
Yes.
That can reach out from the other dimension and hurt you.
Yes.
And that, so having, knowing that for the rest of his life, obviously he'll never be.
He can't go back to the bliss of not knowing.
Yeah. That's it's a little bit of a, it's something you don't think about when you read the, you know, all the ghost stories. Like, the characters move on, but they have to leave, a part of themselves there.
Yeah.
Why does Arthur ignore the many hints and warnings as well as his own misgivings about staying at Eelmarsh House? What is it in his character that impels him to press on? Is there some unconscious motivation, or is Arthur acting rationally? Is he guilty of a kind of hubris in ignoring its warnings? I wouldn't say it's hubris. I just, again, going back to that ignorance, how could he ever know?
Yeah.
You know, he's from London, he's more of a cosmopolitan guy. He's probably thinking, these bumpkins, you know, they're all superstitious. I'll show them. You know, maybe it is a little bit of hubris, but hubris in the idea that, like, I'm a man, I know about the world, the thought of the house being actually haunted probably never crossed his mind.
Yeah.
Ooh, I may have to edit that. What time? Let me see what time I did that. 31. All right. As a healthy young man of sound education and reasonable intelligence and matter-of-fact inclinations, a man of prosaic imagination not given to flights of fancy, Arthur Kipp did not believe in ghosts. But after the strange events at Eelmarsh House, he is now convinced he has indeed seen and heard ghosts. How does Susan Hill want readers to understand the apparently supernatural phenomena presented in the novel? I think she wants people to come away with the idea that, hey, in the world of this story, this is absolutely true. That's what we were just saying in the beginning.
Yeah.
This is a ghost story. This is a ghost. There's no other explanation.
Yeah.
There's no scientific reasoning for it. There's nothing you can do to explain anything otherwise that it's a ghost.
Correct. Yeah, I think she just wants you to believe that they're real, at least in the context of this story.
So at this point, we'll tell you, is Mrs. Drablow had a sister. And Mrs. Drablow had a sister out of wedlock. And Mrs. Drablow's sister had to give the baby up. The sister was named Jeanette. Had to give the baby up for adoption to Mrs. Drablow.
And her husband.
Then the child is killed in a tragic accident. On the pony and trap, heading back to the mainland. And Jeanette, the mother, is hired on as sort of the nursemaid, the governess. So she has contact with her son, but she can never tell her son that she's his real mother. She helps raise. She actually sees the whole accident from the nursery window. She's watching the trap head to the mainland, and it gets washed out into the marsh, and everyone drowns. And it was Mr. Keckwick's father who was driving the trap.
Yes.
The woman in black is, of course, Jeanette, the ghost of Jeanette, in her mourning clothes. And what no one ever told Arthur was that anytime the woman in black appears, a child in the village dies. So it's now sort of Jeanette's revenge that she takes on everybody for taking her child away from her because it's sort of the social pressures of the time make her give up the child for adoption. And so for me, this sort of kind of, it was shades of La Llorona,
yeah,
which is a famous, you know, Mexican folktale about a woman who has to drown her children, who she drowns her children because her husband left her. And then she is, yeah, exactly, right? And then now, then she is cursed to roam the earth looking for her children so that she can get into heaven. And then, not being able to find any, she drowns the children that she finds, hoping to that they're her children. So, that's a great story. Your Latino grandparents probably told you right before bed.
Yeah, nice.
It's a good way to get your keep your kids in line. You better be nice or La Llorona is going to get you. Can't stay out too late. La Llorona is going to get you. So I'm wondering if Susan Hill heard of La Llorona, because it seems very similar. So why doesn't it occur to Arthur that the curse of a child dying after every time the ghost of Jeanette Humphrey is seen might apply to his own child? Are readers more aware of the dangers Arthur faces than he is? So,
well, I think because at the time he learns this fact, he doesn't have a child.
Yeah, he doesn't have a child yet, no.
So there was no incidence of her coming back for on any, like, nobody mentioned, oh, like, every time we see her, like, you think, oh, every time she's seen, a child dies. It seemed like a direct cause and effect of a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, so we didn't have a child, and no child in the village died, because why would we think she was upset with him?
Yeah.
Because I felt like he was always trying to maybe befriend or help her. Like, he always seemed kind to her, whether he thought she was a human or a spirit. He seemed kind to her. And so why would she think she was angry with him?
Yeah, in a way, the way that when he leaves the house, he kind of, the author makes you think that her spirit is finally at rest because of
everybody from the house is gone.
Everybody from that situation. Mrs. Drablo's gone. He's going to take the last remnants of Mrs. Drablo with him. He's going to take the paperwork. He finds the letters and everything where she has to give the baby. So he feels like in this being revealed, this will put the spirit to rest.
Yeah.
At one point, he goes back in the nursery. The nursery's destroyed. So he knows that she has, she can't affect the, even before finding out what happens to the children, he knows that she can't affect the material world.
Yes.
But I think he feels okay. And then his life is quiet for a while. Like, after that, kind of things kind of die, you know.
Yeah.
No pun intended, things kind of die off after he's kind of.
And I think there was mention that there was no child death in the village, so the village kind of thought,
yeah, this,
we're through this.
This black cloud has been lifted.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, there was no reason for him to feel that. Well, first he didn't know, so there's ignorance. But then he assumed that the curse was broken. He assumed that this was done. And so, of course, he went on with his life.
Yeah.
What is the significance of Arthur associating the sounds he hears coming from the nursery with pleasant sounds and feelings from his own childhood? You brought this up.
Yeah.
What do you think the significance of that was?
I'm not 100% sure it had any, like, true significance. Other than, for me, it was like a point, like a fork in the road, where the story could have gone one of two ways. And so, but also, I feel like he struggled with his own beliefs and knowledge, because how could this room be so similar to his?
Mm-hmm.
How could he hear the same rocking chair, like the beat of the rocking chair and the, just the sensation of, this is comforting, like, when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe it was only to have him confront his...
Yeah, do you, in a way, do you think, like, the woman in black was, like, manipulating him to, like, give him this false sense of, like, you know, maybe like, hey, you're safe, it's okay.
Here. Yeah, she might have been.
Yeah. You don't really, that's the thing, you're reading everything, you're interpreting everything through Arthur's interpretation and Arthur's experience, so it's hard to understand exactly what her motivations were. Obviously, she did have malevolent, she was a malevolent spirit, because in, spoiler alert, she ends up taking Arthur's first wife and child in a similar, in an accident similar to the way she lost her own child. He sees her later on, after being married. He sees her at, where they are, like a park? They're at a park? Or like a festival. Kind of a carnival kind of thing.
And yeah.
They go off on the trap and pony, and they're thrown. They're actually killed in a much more violent way.
Yeah.
Than she lost her own children. Or her own child. Why would the dreadful experience of the trap and the pony, along with the driver, mother, and child, need to be repeated in what Arthur describes some dimension other than the normal present one? What purpose would this ghostly reenactment serve?
I feel like it's just, she can't let go. Like, it's her connection to what happened to her.
Yeah.
And this is, of all the horrible things that have happened to her, like, obviously this is the worst thing, and she witnessed it, and so she's going to continue to just play this over and over every single night for anybody that happens to be around.
Do you feel like it's her rage? Like, she knows it's scaring people, and, like...
Could be.
Like, in the story of La Llorona, it's the whole thing is she goes to heaven, and they're like, where are your children? And... I haven't my children in here. Well, you need to go bring them. You can't get in unless you can't enter the spirit world, or you can't enter heaven unless your children are with you. So go find your children.
Yeah.
So she goes back to Earth to find her children. And yes, that's why it's a ghost story, kid. So she cries. You know, that's why she's crying over because she can't find her children. I mean, for selfish reasons, but she's crying. Yeah, so for me, this could be like a way to sort of draw people in. You know, if she's doing this on the marsh, people are going to investigate. And they're, you know, they're...
Possibly because, like, Spider went out and got stuck in the marsh.
Oh, Spider survives, by the way. Great dog, Spider.
Yes. So, but, you know, he was drawn out by the noise. Mm-hmm. And he got stuck in, like, the quicksandy sort of mm-hmm. stuff, and he almost drowned in there. So yeah, it could be either a draw to get people, or also to keep people off her little island.
Yeah, for me, it's I think she's just trying to draw people to their doom. She's now, this is vengeance. I lost my child, and now you're all, everyone's going to pay.
Yeah.
You know, I will make other people suffer the way I suffered. Your parents will suffer the way I suffered. In what sense is Jeanette a victim of the social and religious conventions of her time? How much sympathy does she elicit? Well, I mean, obviously, it's Victorian England. She can't be an unwed mother. That's just not something that a respectable woman would do in those times. There's nothing for her to do. So she has to give the baby up. She's forced to do it.
Yeah.
And maybe Mrs. Drabble thought she was doing her a favor by, like, hey, you're my sister, and I'm going to let you... You'll be here.
And you'll stay, and you'll help raise him.
Mm-hmm.
So you still, you know, you won't ever have to worry if he's being taken care of or any of
but
that.
But it is implied that she was forced into the decision. Her sister did force her into the decision. And so you assume that this Mrs. Drabble, who lived to be a ripe old age, lived every night haunted by her sister.
Yes.
Which is also just a whole, that adds a whole other element to the whole story.
And, you know, early in the story we get the picture that Mrs. Drablo, although she lived in this big house, only used very few rooms, like one drawing room, the kitchen, you know, her bedroom sort of thing. So she probably did the best she could to kind of just keep the peace and keep her, like, give her the rest of the house, and she was just going to use small portions of it.
You feel sympathy for her because
I feel sympathy for her.
As a human life. Yes.
And then when you realize what she's become in the afterlife, you lose some sympathy for her.
While he's recuperating in Mr. Daly's, Arthur observes a robin on the balustrade outside his window and watches it with a feeling of great absorption and contentment. Before coming to Criven Gifford, that's the name of the song, Criven Gifford, Arthur says he would have never been able to concentrate on such an ordinary thing so completely, but would have been restless to be up and off doing this or that busily. Why would the terrible events at Eelmarsh House have this positive effect on Arthur? In what ways have those events changed him? I feel it's like when you meet people who have a near-death experience.
Yeah, exactly.
They just have an appreciation for life. You know, the miracle of life. I think he's just happy to be alive.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one point thought, I never thought I was going to hear another bird sing or see another bird.
Yeah. He thought him and Spider were gonzo.
Yeah. Spider got drawn in. I wonder how many animals get drawn in by the... See, she's killing animals. I can't. I'm not on board
with you. We cannot abide.
I can't, yeah. Cannot be on board. Sorry, Ghost. I can't be on board with you. What did you think of the book as a whole? I mean, did you...
I liked it.
Yeah.
It was, again, not... It's not my general genre that I am drawn to. I typically don't do scary stories, but I liked it. It was not super long. Like, I've got it at, with the thing, 165.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a long story that's going to take somebody like me who's super slow at reading, you know, months and months to read. And it was easy to pick up and put down. Like, I read it at camp. I read it, like, here and there. I'd read it at break at lunch, at work and stuff. So it was easy to put down and pick back up and feel like you still had the story and stuff. So I liked it. It was a very entertaining story.
Yeah, it's a really... it makes me want to read more of Susan Hill. I do like her style. I hear the chair keep squeaking. I'm sorry. But I like her style. I like her writing style in this book. And I would definitely... It's a nice, well... Like, tightly wound little story.
Yes.
You know, good pacing, good plotting. You always feel like the character... If the story's not moving forward, you're at least getting some aspect of what the character's thinking and his reaction to everything that's happening.
Yeah, you get more depth and more ambiance and all of that in the points where the story's not moving forward.
I feel like it is a quick read, but you'll want to read it fast too. You kind of want to get peel back the layers.
Nothing felt unnecessary.
Exactly, yeah. She's always moving the way... If she's not moving the character forward, she's developing the... I'm sorry, if she's not moving the plot forward, she's developing the character in some way. I would give this... I loved it. I'd give this book an 8. I'm going to give it an 8 using our regular rating system.
I'm always bad at rating, but... Yeah, I'm going to say an 8.
Because I would recommend this to anybody. Whether you're into horror or not, I would recommend it.
Yeah, because it's not too scary.
If I knew somebody was into a Downton Abbey, I'd be like, hey, read this book. You'll love it. You know, it's a well-written book. It's easy to read. And if somebody's looking for something different, you know, it did kind of throw me that it's just a literal ghost story. Like, you're right. I was waiting for some kind of like, but it's like, okay, we're just going to do a straight ghost story, which I like as well. I like that as well. So yeah, I'm going to give this one an 8. So great recommendation, Stephanie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. We're going to dig into the TV movie that I found on YouTube.
Oh, so. I was super scared.
What did you think we were going
to... I was like, I don't know where he's going with this.
No, we're
going
to dig into that one. So if you have any books you want to recommend for us, we'll try to keep it on the lighter side. You know, we don't want any 1,000-page novels or anything like that, just because we both have to read at our own pace.
And I'm simple folk. I don't like to read anything too crazy.
That's not true. You read all of the Harry Potter books.
Yeah, super simple.
You read...
There is junior fiction. It's written for children.
Listen, there are a lot of adults... Now, I say that to people all the time, but there are a lot of adults who are going to take umbrage with that. So...
where is it sold in the bookstore?
Listen, I have a lot of comic books to read, too. I'm backlogged. So, no, with that in mind, if you want to recommend us something to read, something you think we'd enjoy, we're pretty much open to
anything.
Something
you'd like to hear us blather on about.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be fun. But it was a good book. I'm really glad I read it. I would have never read it otherwise.
Yeah.
The movie, the preview for the movie didn't look especially good, so would have never seen the movie. Yeah, I'm definitely going to check out the TV movie. I think it's BBC or something.
Mm-hmm. That's always fun.
From the 80s. So,
ooh, even more fun.
Even more fun, yeah. Yeah, so eight from Nicole. That's Susan Hill's Woman in Black. We're going to run some ads at the end of this episode, so please check out our friends, the Castaways. You can follow us on Twitter at Soup Complex, S-O-U-P Complex. We drop new shows usually every Wednesday. We have a big group of people that we kind of just talk about different facets of pop culture every week. Every other week we do our Digital Movie Club. We are going through my entire digital movie collection. We're about to start the 1980s in the fall, so get on board with that.
It's where it gets dicey.
Every other week, we discuss three movies, usually with people that haven't seen most of them. So that's a lot of fun. You can follow us, like I said, at Soup Complex, or you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Soup Complex. If you want to send a recommendation, you can send it there, or you can send it to our Gmail address, superioritycomplexshow@gmail.com. Until then, you have anything to say? Closing words?
No.
All right. Fight the power. This transmission ends now.
Hey, this is Liz.
Hey, this is Heather.
And we are Nerdy Bitches Podcast,
a show where two geeky ladies podcast their way through pop culture.
From movies and TV to our regular book club and everything in between, we bring you our favorite fandoms with a feminine eye.
We are talking Star Wars, Star Trek, DC, Marvel, comic books, and anime.
And don't forget sci-fi, fantasy, action movies, video games, D&D, board games, and so much more.
Be sure to check us out on Apple Podcast, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you find awesome podcasts.
You can also find us hanging out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and at nerdybitches.com.
See you soon.
Hey, I heard you like movies.
I heard you like to hustle.
I heard you like podcasts.
Well, guess what?
There's a podcast for you out there called The Home Video Hustle.
Damn right.
Every Friday, we talk about whatever movie PJ picks out the bag. What does that mean? Every Wednesday on our YouTube page, I put a bunch of movies in a bag, and PJ picks one out at random. And then we just watch it, and we talk about it for maybe like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever we feel like doing, wherever the conversation leads us.
But do we actually talk about the movie?
Most of the time.
Ah.
Tangents galore.
Yes.
So believe me, we may be a movie podcast, but it's not always about movies. We might talk about video games.
Mm-hmm. Music. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the big one, music. Sometimes we might get a little bit of politicalness in there.
Yes.
Sometimes we may just, we know what we like to do. We like to tell stories, PJ.
Ah, yes.
I am the master storyteller
yes.
of the podcast realm. undefeated. So if you like to hear about movies, video games, whatever foolishness comes to our mind, the most random stuff you can think of, check out the Home Video Hustle. You can find us on the Stitchers.
Yes.
The Google Play.
Yes.
Apple Podcasts.
What else?
Podbean.
What else?
Podcast Addict.
Goddamn.
All that. Ain't no reason you can't get your hustle on. We everywhere. Worldwide, baby.
Hustle, motherfucker. Hustle.
Hey, we can't cuss in the promo, PJ. We gotta be family friendly. There may be podcasts out there that don't want his hair to say all that good fun stuff.
Well, you.
don't run the listeners away, PJ.
I'm sorry.
But this is going kind of long.
Yes.
So we'll end this and say, hey, check out the Home Video Hustle every Friday on all the various podcast outlets. Peace.
Peace.